From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On last week's episode of The Sopranos, Tony Soprano's impulsive nephew Christopher was shot several times. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the actor who plays Christopher, Michael Imperioli. Among the over 30 films he's appeared in is Goodfellas, in which he was shot by Joe Pesci. Also, we talk with Sonia Sanchez and Michael Harper, two of the writers featured on a CD collecting African-American poets of the 20th century. We'll hear poems by Sanchez and Harper, and they'll play selections by poets who inspired them. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Bill Bradley has ended his presidential bid. He said now's the time for unity in the Democratic Party. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Bradley's campaign had a very strong start and high expectations, but his momentum fizzled early and he never won a single primary. Although the battle between Bradley and Vice President Gore had been bitter, Bradley says it's the tradition of the Democratic Party to fight hard, then close ranks.
Democrats know that the offerings of the likely Republican nominee and his party are the opposite of where our country should be headed. This country needs Democratic leadership, and I will work to ensure a Democratic White House and Congress.
But Bradley says he hopes that Gore will conduct a campaign that has less distortion and negativity in the fall. If Gore doesn't, Bradley says, he won't hesitate to say how he feels about it. Mara Liasson, NPR News, New Jersey.
Senator John McCain suspended his campaign for the Republican presidential nomination today. He said he wants to continue his push for campaign finance reform, and he didn't throw his support to his GOP rival, Texas Governor George W. Bush. U.S. and NATO officials are denying a report that a spy at NATO headquarters leaked bombing secrets to Serbia last year during the fight over Kosovo. The charge comes in a BBC television documentary to be broadcast next Sunday. More from NPR's Tom Jelton.
The BBC report alleges that a spy within the NATO structure provided Serbia with information about bombing targets during the early phase of NATO's air war. The program cites a classified U.S. military after-action report, but a senior U.S. defense official familiar with that report says the spy charge is absolutely false. The official, whose Pentagon responsibilities included oversight of the Kosovo operation, says, "We do not feel that information was compromised." The BBC program quotes officials as saying that during the first few weeks of the bombing campaign, 600 people inside NATO had access to daily air tasking orders, which included bombing targets. A NATO spokesman said today access to that information was sharply restricted as the bombing campaign proceeded, but he insisted there is no clear evidence that a spy inside NATO had passed the information to Belgrade. Tom Jelton, NPR News, Washington.
The Miami relatives of Elian Gonzalez tried to convince a federal judge today to keep the 6-year-old Cuban boy in the United States instead of returning him to his father in Cuba. U.S. District Judge Michael Moore must decide whether the Miami relatives can legally challenge a ruling from the Immigration and Naturalization Service that ordered the child returned to his father. The boy was rescued from the waters off the coast of Florida in November after his mother and other would-be refugees drowned when their boat sank. In stocks today, the Dow gained 154 points, or 1.5%, to close at 10,010. This is NPR News. A 10-year-old girl in Florida is safely back home with her family. The man who allegedly kidnapped her from her driveway 3 days ago remains at large. David Shermer reports from member station WUFT in Gainesville.
Just before noon, Jessica Rodriguez walked into a Gainesville Walmart store and told a clerk she had just been dropped off in the parking lot by a man who kidnapped her on Monday. Within minutes, sheriff's deputies picked her up and took her to a hospital for evaluation and a reunion with her family. Her mother says Jessica is fine. Florida Law Enforcement Regional Director Ken Tucker says the investigation now shifts.
We're at the point now where we don't have the concern over worrying over Jessica's safety at this point. We can now concentrate and focus our efforts on this suspect, on identifying him, and on apprehending him.
Tucker says officers have a description of the kidnapper and his sport utility vehicle, but they have no idea what motivated him. For NPR, I'm Dave Schirmer in Gainesville, Florida.
The Senate confirmed two of President Clinton's nominees to federal judgeships today, years after their names were proposed for the jobs. The votes confirmed Californians Richard A. Páez and Marsha Berzon to seats on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Votes on the two nominees had been blocked by conservative Republicans who said that both judges were too liberal and activist. President Clinton nominated Páez 4 years ago and Berzon 2 years ago. Berzon is currently a San Francisco judge who was opposed by conservatives because of her work with labor groups. Páez is a judge on the Federal District Court in Los Angeles. In stocks today, the Nasdaq gained 150 points to close at a record 5,047. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Yo, Christopher, what's up?
Hey, what's up, man?
At the end of last week's episode of The Sopranos, Tony Soprano's nephew and protege, Christopher Moltisanti, was shot several times by two young guys who worked for him. So what's going to happen to Christopher? My guest is the actor who plays him, Michael Imperioli. He's not about to divulge any Soprano secrets, but we will get a chance to find out more about the show and about Michael Imperioli's work. Imperioli has appeared in over 30 films, including Goodfellas, Jungle Fever, Clockers, Household Saints, and I Shot Andy Warhol. He co-wrote and executive produced Spike Lee's Summer of Sam. Imperioli's character on The Sopranos, Christopher, likes to go his own way, and that always creates a lot of tension between him and his uncle. A couple of episodes ago, Christopher didn't show up to Tony's son's confirmation. When Christopher showed up later for the party, Tony was pretty angry.
Where the f*** you been?
It's for AJ.
I got one son and you miss his confirmation ceremony?
I figure with all my sins, I don't want the church caving in on everyone. No lectures, all right, Tony? I'm not in the mood.
I agree. I'm gonna go back in there and be with my guests. Exactly 10 minutes, I'm gonna look up. If you're not here, I'm gonna assume that you went to look for whatever the f*** it is that's calling you out there. And that I will never see you again. If you are still here, then I'm going to assume that you got no other desire in the world but to be with me. And your actions will show me that every f***ing second of every f***ing day. Now, you understand me? Don't answer me. Take the 10 minutes. You think about it.
I asked Michael Imperioli to tell us more about his character on The Sopranos.
I'm kind of a younger, more hot-headed, impulsive, young mobster who wants to be made into the mafia, which means officially become a member and go through the oath and ritual, which assures you a lifetime place in that family. And often my attempts to do that kind of backfire and cause me to get into more trouble. But he's a hard worker, and I think he has a good heart.
When you started working on The Sopranos, was most of your knowledge about the mob from movies and TV shows?
Well, yeah, I mean, I had done a couple of roles, and for those roles, I did a lot of research. So, I mean, the territory was not unfamiliar because of that, because of the research that I did, and just the history of, how the mob began and, took root in New York and then in the rest of the country, from like the 20s, I guess, onward. So I was familiar with that stuff, and I guess just the life and the kind of characterizations and the type of people is something that I was familiar with from growing up.
What kind of neighborhood did you grow up in?
I grew up in a mostly Italian neighborhood in Mount Vernon, which is right on the border of the Bronx in New York.
Were there guys who were rumored to be in the mafia, or guys who you knew for sure were?
There were guys who were connected to them, but not guys who, I would say, were made guys who were part of the family that lived in my immediate neighborhood. No.
And what was your attitude toward them? Were there people you looked up to or people you wanted to stay away from?
Well, you know, when we were kids growing up, The Godfather was like hero. You know, that was hero worship to us. The Godfather kind of made us proud to be Italian because, I mean, we didn't look at them, those characters, as just violent, you know, criminals. We looked them at them with appreciation because of their sense of being empowered in American society and being able to kind of take the law into their own hands. And we also were attracted to these bonds of loyalty and blood, you know, blood family, I mean, that version of blood, and tradition. We actually had a sense of pride about those characters. And I think that's why a lot of people still, you know, I guess, look up to that movie. They feel something for these characters. They don't feel a revulsion for these characters. They really feel like a respect and an admiration for just the way they treated each other and the way they looked at what their lives were about.
When you said that you did research on the mob, did you try to go out and meet guys who were connected or just read books?
Well, no, it's more like reading books and kind of observing, you know, going to certain places and observing. I would never, like, seek out people that I didn't know and try to, you know. Also, yeah, I don't really know who these people are. I mean, I wouldn't know where to... I mean, you can see, like, they used to show the social club that Gotti, you know, worked out of in Little Italy. Everyone kind of knew where that was, but I would never think of going, knocking on the door and saying, I'm an actor doing a movie. I'd love to talk to you guys. I mean, you know, there's certain clubs or restaurants where people of that world may frequent, and you can go and try to absorb and
did you do that?
Drink up. Yeah, I did that at different times.
If you're just joining us, my guest is actor Michael Imperioli, one of the stars now of The Sopranos. He plays Christopher Moltisanti, Tony Soprano's nephew and soldier. When we left off in The Sopranos, your character was shot at the end of the episode. And, you know, we don't know what's going to happen to him, whether he'll pull through, and if he does, how this is going to change his life, his attitudes, his health. When did you know that your character was going to be shot?
I think I knew that about a year ago.
Really?
Yeah.
Gee, I'm really surprised. I wouldn't have thought that they'd think it through that completely. I mean, that far along.
Oh, they think it through very completely.
Uh-huh. Well, when you're shot, you don't know whether you're getting written out of the series or not. Or did they tell you that you weren't?
I had no idea. I didn't know what they were doing. And I still don't. You know, we taped two different versions of the rest of the season. One where I live and one where I die. And I don't know which one what they're going to go with on the air.
Seriously?
No.
Oh, okay. Okay.
No, you know what? We're all sworn to secrecy.
Right. Other things you've had to learn to do for The Sopranos that you haven't had to do before, even things like saying in a really, you know, whiny, annoyed way, what? I didn't get that quite right, but...
Oh, that's from being, you know, Italian-American and, you know, a New Yorker. He's from New Jersey, my character, but it's pretty much the metropolitan area there. That I don't have to work on.
Mm-hmm.
That's in there.
What
I
did have to work
I
on,
did
yeah.
have to get a driver's license, though.
Right, because you're the driver in it.
And I never really knew how to drive. I actually smashed a car during the shooting of the pilot, during a take.
Who taught you to drive?
I took lessons.
Like from a Joe's driving school kind of place, or
yeah, in Manhattan, which is
oh,
like
Manhattan's
probably
awful to learn
the
to
worst place. My first lesson, the guy comes to my house, picks me up. At the time, I was living on the block. It was 54th Street near Lexington, which at the time was the worst block in the city for traffic. He picks me up in the middle of the day, in the afternoon, says, "Okay, get in and drive." I'm like, "What? In this?" And the traffic wasn't even moving. It was horrendous. But now I drive.
Do you drive in Manhattan?
No, I drive on the show. I don't really drive in real life because I don't have enough experience.
My guest is Michael Imperioli, and he plays Christopher Moltisanti in The Sopranos, Tony Soprano's nephew and soldier. Now, you, before The Sopranos, you had a small part in Goodfellas,
yeah.
One of Martin Scorsese's movies about the mob, about people at the lower echelon. Describe your part in Goodfellas.
I played a kid who worked in the social club where these wise guys hung out. And, you know, when young kids do that kind of job, they do anything from, like, sweeping up to, you know, going to make food runs or make coffee or bring coffee. Or in the movie, specifically, you see me serving drinks at a card game. I may go buy them a sandwich if they wanted it, or make them a sandwich for the card game, or, you know, clean up when they're done and do whatever they need. Kind of like a gopher of sorts. That was my character. His name was Spider.
And you get shot.
Yeah, well, that was based on a true story, apparently, from what I understand, that there was a character who was this kid, and one of the guys kind of was getting a little hot under the collar and was fooling around and wanted me to, like, in an old Western, you know, move a little quicker. So he was shooting the ground. He wound up shooting me in the foot. And then in the next scene, he's kind of bothering me and saying, come on, you know, kind of doing the same thing. And I have this huge bandage on my foot. And I get upset and kind of tell him to go, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he gets really upset and winds up killing me. But it's kind of, it happens right in the middle of the movie, and it's, I think, there was no reason really for me to my character to die, and it kind of really showed, that was Joe Pesci who shot my character in the movie, and it was a point in the movie where it really kind of shows he's taken a turn into, like, I guess depravity, where he's really, it's not about business anymore, it's really, he's just kind of becoming psychotic, where he's just killing whoever he wants to for whatever reason.
Let's hear an excerpt of that scene.
Even though you got that, you could dance, huh? Give us a couple of f***ing steps here, Spider. Bullshit for you. Tell the truth, you're looking for sympathy. Is that it, sweetie?
Why don't you go f*** yourself, Tommy?
Oh. You're right. I couldn't believe what I just heard.
Hey, Spider, here. Yeah, this is for you. Attaboy.
I got respect for this. He's got a lot of f***ing balls. Good for you. Don't take no shit off nobody. He shoots him in the foot. He tells him to go f*** himself. You're gonna let him get away with that? You're gonna let the punk get away with that? What's the matter? What's the world coming to?
What the f***ing world is coming to? How do you like that?
When the Joe Pesci character is really going over the edge as he's shooting at you, did you feel that Joe Pesci was really doing something transformational in himself in that scene?
Oh, no. I mean, you get into it and you're doing your thing. I mean, I think I was too involved in my thing to, like, be taken out of it and think, wow, he's really going somewhere else. I mean, we were into our own parts and playing it to the hilt. I mean, I never felt he was out of control or that I had to, you know. Although I did get hurt, you know, in the scene when they killed me. In the first take, when I'm getting shot, I hit the ground and I had an actual glass in my hand which shattered. And I sliced two of my fingers open. So I got rushed to a hospital out in Queens, but I had these huge bullet holes and blood all over my chest. And as they rushed me to the hospital, as I went into the hospital, they rushed at me and put me on a stretcher, and I'm trying to explain to them that it was my hand, and they just thought I was delirious and wouldn't listen to anything I was saying and thought, you know, they were going to have to do some kind of, I don't know, trauma surgery or whatever the hell they were going to have to do. And then they finally understood and saw all the rigging for the blood packs and stuff like that, and everybody kind of had a laugh, and it was very funny.
Sounds to me like a very effective way to get by the triage nurse.
It was exactly that. But once they found out that it was just then just my fingers, they made me wait a long time.
Tell me what it was like to work on a movie with De Niro and Joe Pesci and Scorsese.
You know, I learned a lot watching Robert De Niro. I mean, to be 22 years old and all of a sudden be on the set with Robert De Niro and be an Italian kid from New York and be working with this guy, that was like, I mean, it was really a dream. Those 2 days, I mean, the whole experience of being in that proximity was really a dream. But I watched him a lot, and what I watched from him was economy. He would come to the set, and immediately when he'd be on the set, he wouldn't kind of dissipate his energies. He would be very focused and immediately start to be involved with his props or his, you know, if he was sitting at the card table, when he got to the set, he'd sit down. He'd get his drink and, his prop drink and his props and shuffle the cards or whatever. But I remember watching him on the set, no time was ever wasted, like just kind of sitting around, talking or just, socializing or anything like that. When they cut, he would leave the set. Like he treated the space of the set as something almost sacred, not to be wasted, not to expend superfluous energy on that, like a stage. When an actor does a play, you come onto the stage and you do your part and then you get off the stage. And it seemed he was treating the movie set the same way. Whereas a movie set, you can come on and just like talk and fool around. And some people do that and that's fine. But economy was the thing that I kept seeing that he was doing to keep his energies there. So when the camera's rolling and he's doing a take, you can have your energy be full out.
So you were 22. Did you want to talk to De Niro all about The Godfather and Taxi Driver, or did you want to leave him alone?
No. The first day, Scorsese came up to me and said, the only thing I ask of you is on and off camera, you treat them as their characters, which actually was very freeing because I would have been a nervous, stumbling, fan, if I had to say, well, what was it like doing this or that? This actually took the pressure off, because the first time I actually was in the room with De Niro, he came and sat down on the set, and I went up to him and asked him what he wanted to drink, because I was in charge of the drinks. And he kind of just looked at me, and then he said, I'll take a shot of scotch and a glass of water. There was no alcohol on the set. It was all props, but it made it very easy, because I didn't have to be, he didn't have to be one of the greatest actors of all time, and I'm this, young guy who admires him so much. Although, in essence, that's kind of what our characters were, because he was a very well-respected mobster, and I was someone who looked up to him. But I didn't break that character till I was done with the 2 days, and I said goodbye to him. And he was very kind and offered me words of encouragement, and that was it. But it made it very easy to do that.
My guest is Michael Imperioli. He plays Christopher Moltisanti on The Sopranos. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Imperioli. He plays Tony Soprano's nephew, Christopher, on The Sopranos. Anyone in your family or extended family ever say to you, Michael, why are you doing all these mafia roles? It stereotypes Italians.
Not in my family. Also, the funny thing is, I think I've done about maybe 35 or something more than that movies, a handful of TV roles, a bunch of plays. And out of all those roles, I think I've only done about 4, maybe 5 mobsters.
But some of those are your best-known work.
The people love those movies and stuff. So that's, I've never felt typecast, because I've always, since I started working, always.
Oh, sure. Well, you were on Dean, and I shot Andy Warhol.
Yeah, I've always
been.
You
were in a lot of independent films playing all kinds of characters.
I've been offered a range of characters, and I haven't felt typecast. The thing about Sopranos is it's not like doing a movie. This is something that's over an extended period of time. Now we're in our second season. So, we've already shot 26 episodes, so that's 26 hours, which is, about 13 feature films. So that's a lot of time spent on one character, but that's the nature of doing TV. And it's a luxury when you're playing characters that are so, thought out and working with such great material and great company.
On The Sopranos, you work with a lot of character actors, many of whom are from an older generation than you are. And I'm wondering if you think that the opportunities for character actors are different for your generation than older generations, in part because a lot of actors like you have started off in independent films or like you had have their own or had their own production companies, and therefore more kind of more freedom and more flexibility, more maybe more opportunity?
I think there's just more opportunity. I think there's just a lot more things to act in these days. I mean, there's just, look at how many channels there are. You have to, you know, you got to fill those up with stuff. You know, before when I was growing up, there was, what, 5 channels. There wasn't really an independent film thing the way there is today. There wasn't a lot of low-budget movies. There was people who made films independently, you know, like Cassavetes, people like that. But there wasn't a ton of, like, low-budget films being made in New York that you can, as a young actor, start to get into and cut your teeth on. I think back then it was a lot more closed, you know. It was a lot more hard to break in.
I'm wondering if any of the character actors have spoken to you or if you've overheard them talking to each other about some of the frustrations that they've faced not having leading men good looks.
No, I think you're better off because there's a lot fewer leading men. See, it's and a lot fewer parts. I mean, if you think about it, in 1 year, how many leading men roles are there, and how many actors get to fill those things out? You know, because you got to be box office if you're going to be a leading man and a big star. There's only a handful of people who fill those shoes. Whereas if you're, you know, if you can do that and you're in that world, then you're set. But for character actors who are not of that kind of type, there's, you know, lots of parts, some big, some small, some medium that you can, you know, all the time. So I think it's a little bit easier.
What else do you have coming up?
The March 12th episode, the premieres, is something that is an episode that I wrote, which was a lot of fun. And
well, that's the episode right after the episode in which you got shot.
That's right.
So does that mean that you had the power to determine what happens to your character, or were that you given parameters and you could write within them?
Both.
Okay, and you're not going to tell us anything.
I can't.
Right.
No, you know what it is? I wouldn't want to spoil it for anybody.
Right. Right.
I don't even tell my family.
It's like being in the CIA.
It's, I guess so. I wonder.
Michael Imperioli. He plays Christopher Moltisanti on The Sopranos. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House and its Harmony Books division, publisher of How to Know God, The Soul's Journey into the Mysteries of Mysteries by Deepak Chopra, M.D. From Turner Classic Movies, presenting 31 Days of Oscar. Tomorrow night, Showboat. And from Princeton University Press, publishers of The Eternal Darkness, A Personal History of Deep Sea Exploration by the oceanographer Robert Ballard. In bookstores or online at www.pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio. A new CD of 20th century African-American poets ranges from Langston Hughes to Public Enemy. Coming up, we talk with two poets featured on it, Sonia Sanchez and Michael Harper. They'll read from their own work and choose selections by poets who influence them. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Langston Hughes, W.E.B. Du Bois, James Weldon Johnson, County Cullen, Gwendolyn Brooks, and Lucille Clifton are among the great 20th century writers represented on the new double CD anthology, Our Souls Have Grown Deep Like the Rivers, Black Poets Read Their Work. The CD collects historical recordings along with readings by contemporary poets, including a rap record by Public Enemy. My guests are two of the poets represented on the CD, Sonia Sanchez and Michael Harper. I asked them each to choose a track by a late poet who inspired them. Michael Harper chose a poem called Strong Men by Sterling Brown. I asked Harper to tell us a little about Sterling Brown and the poem.
Well, Sterling wrote this poem in 1929, and Sterling was a virtuoso, knew everything, studied the blues, was a classical scholar, knew a great deal about Shakespeare, knew Chaucer, knew John Milton, knew the Romantics, and at the same time he knew his people, loved his people.
Well, let's hear this poem by Sterling Brown, recorded by Sterling Brown at the Library of Congress in 1973. This is Strong Men.
Strong men, the strong men keep coming on, Carl Sandburg. They dragged you from homeland, they chained you in coffles, they huddled you, spoon fashion, in filthy hatches. They sold you to give a few gentlemen ease. They broke you in like oxen. They scourged you. They branded you. They made your women breeders. They swelled your numbers with bastards. They taught you the religion they disgraced. You sang, keep inching along like a poe-inch worm. You sang, by and by I'm gonna lay down this heavy load. You sang, walk together, chillin'. Don't you get weary. The strong men keep a-coming on, the strong men get stronger. They point with pride to the road you built for them. They ride in comfort over the rails you laid for them. They put hammers in your hands and said, drive so much before sundown. You sang, ain't no hammer in this land. Strikes like mine, baby. Strikes like mine. They cooked you in their kitchen. They penned you in their factories. They gave you the jobs that they were too good for. They tried to guarantee happiness to themselves by shunting dirt and misery to you. You sang, me and my baby gonna shine, shine. Me and my baby gonna shine. The strong men keep a-coming on. The strong men get stronger. They bought off some of your leaders. You stumbled, as blind men will. They coaxed you unwontedly soft-voiced. You followed away, then laughed as usual. They heard the laugh and wondered, uncomfortable, unadmitting a deeper terror. The strong men keep a-coming on, getting stronger. What from the slums where they have hemmed you? What from the tiny huts they could not keep from you? What reaches them, making them ill at ease, fearful? Today they shout prohibitions at you. Thou shalt not this, thou shalt not that, reserved for whites only. You laugh. One thing they cannot prohibit, the strong men coming on, the strong men getting stronger, strong men stronger.
And that was Sterling Brown reading his poem Strong Men, as recorded at the Library of Congress in 1973. And that poem is included on the new CD, Our Souls Have Grown Deep Like the Rivers, Black Poets Read Their Work. And I have two poets in the studio with me, Michael Harper and Sonia Sanchez. Michael Harper, you chose to play that poem. Sterling Brown read it really well. I'm wondering if you feel he influenced your style of performing your poetry.
Well, I certainly did. I heard his voice on the FM radio one day. I was driving down the freeway, and I just literally couldn't believe the resonance and voice that he had. And, of course, I went down to the public library in San Francisco. I was living in San Francisco at the time. And there was a Folkways album that he had made of his poems, and I read them. and there was no collection at the time. He had been in anthologies. But the voice, the resonance, and the range that he had was tremendously influential, even before I met him. Luckily, I met him in 1972, and we were close until he died. But he was a preeminent man. Not only was he a tremendous scholar and teacher, a magnificent teacher, but he was a tremendous reader of his own work.
Did you get close to him, and did he give you any advice about what it would be to live life as a poet?
Well, he gave me a lot of advice. He was known as an autodidact. I mean, you know, a short answer for Sterling Brown was an hour or more. He was an incredible man. You know, the first thing he told me was that black writers, by definition, were here to disturb the peace, that is to say, to tell the truth, and that the popularity, they couldn't expect popularity, and they couldn't expect to be in publication often, and sometimes they'd be running counter to the market, whatever it was. And he also had long experience with being out of print, and he used to say that one of the responsibilities for any black artist was to be true to the people. And if it took you to revolutionary stance, the reason why it was a revolutionary stance is simply because it was truthful, and so much of American society is based on lies.
Michael Harper, I'm going to ask you to read one of your own poems for us.
Okay. I'll read Dear John to Coltrane.
That happens to be the poem of yours, or one of the poems of yours that's included on the CD, Our Souls Have Grown Deep Like the Rivers, but I'm going to ask you to read it for us.
Okay. Dear John to Coltrane. A love supreme, a love supreme, a love supreme, a love supreme. Sex. Fingers, toes, in the marketplace near your father's church in Hamlet, North Carolina. Witness to this love in this calm fallow of these minds. There is no substitute for pain. Genitals gone or going. Seed burned out. You tuck the roots in the earth, turn back and move by river through the swamps, singing, a love supreme, a love supreme. What does it all mean? Loss, so great each black woman expects your failure in mute change, the seed gone. You plod up into the electric city, your song now crystal and the blues. You pick up the horn with some will and blow into the freezing night, a love supreme, a love supreme. Dawn comes and you cook up the thick sin between impotence and death, fuel the tenor sax cannibal heart, genitals and sweat. That makes you clean. A love supreme, a love supreme. Why you so black, cause I am. Why you so funky, cause I am. Why you so black, cause I am. Why you so sweet, cause I am. Why you so black, cause I am. A love supreme, a love supreme. So sick you couldn't play Naima. So flat we ached for song you'd concealed with your own blood. Your diseased liver gave out its purity. The inflated heart pumps out the tenor kiss, tenor love, a love supreme, a love supreme, a love supreme, a love supreme.
It's Michael Harper reading his poem, Dear John, Dear Coltrane. Were you listening to, obviously you must have been listening to a lot of Coltrane while writing this. Had you seen him perform shortly before writing this?
Well, I began to watch Coltrane play live in about 1955. And I wrote the poem actually before Coltrane died. Coltrane died in 1967. I wrote the poem in 1966. And I was terrified because, you know, as poets, you sometimes have material select you. And I, of course, knew his music and listened to him live many times. I'd written about his great drummer, Elvin Jones, and McCoy Tyner was a friend of mine. We were the same age and pretty much grew up together. But Coltrane was a special figure, and he was not a terribly talkative man, and I had spent many, many times being in his company. But when I wrote this poem, I was terrified that I was writing his death warrant or something. And the reason why the refrain, A Love Supreme, is because he himself had played that in 1964, and he and his musicians had chanted that. And it was a refrain, a kind of anthem, which became widespread among the black community, the musical community, and Coltrane was the superior musician of his generation.
Speaking with poet Michael Harper, he'll be back with poet Sonia Sanchez after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are poets Michael Harper and Sonia Sanchez. They're both featured on the new CD, Our Souls Have Grown Deep Like the Rivers, Black Poets Read Their Work. Here's a track featuring Sonia Sanchez reading her poem, Song Number 2, recorded in 1994.
I say, all you young girls waiting to live. I say, all you young girls taking your pill. I say, all your sisters tired of standing still. I say, all your sisters thinking you won't, but you will. Don't let them kill you with their stare. Don't let them closet you with no air. Don't let them feed you sex piecemeal. Don't let them offer you any ordeal. I say, step back, sisters, we rising from the dead. I say, step back, Johnnies, we dancing on our heads. I say, step back, man, no more hanging by a thread. I say, step back, world, can't let it all go unsaid, too. I say, all you young girls molested at 10. I say, all you young girls giving it up again and again. I say, all you sisters hanging out in every den. I say, all you sisters needing your own oxygen. Don't let them trap you with their coke. Don't let them treat you like one fat joke. Don't let them bleed you till you broke. Don't let them blind you in masculine smoke. I say, step back, sisters, we rising from the dead. I say, step back. Back Johnnies, we dancing on our heads. I say, step back, man, no more hanging by a thread. I say, step back, world, can't let it all go unsaid. I say, step back, world, can't let it all go unsaid.
That's Sonia Sanchez as featured on a new CD featuring African-American poets reading their work. I asked her to choose a track featuring a late poet who inspired her. She chose the poem For My People by Margaret Walker. Before we hear it, let's talk about Margaret Walker. Sonia, you said you met Margaret Walker. She was the kind of person you could pick up the phone and just talk to. What did it mean to you as a young poet to have somebody like her to commiserate with when you were getting your bearings as a writer?
She certainly was one who had gone through a lot here in this country, and she certainly was one who could give you great information on people who had gone before. I mean, you could call her when you were teaching Langston Hughes or anyone, and she would tell you some really relevant and pertinent information about those people. But the thing that one really loved about what we used to call her, Miss Margaret, was simply that she had a look. She had looked at this earth and made a decision to be a certain kind of poet, a certain kind of woman, and she never veered from that at all.
Sonia, can I ask you, this might be too personal, but can I ask you of an example of a time when you felt you really needed to commiserate with Margaret Walker, when something had happened with your writing or with your work as a teacher or a performer of your poetry, and you just really felt you needed her advice?
Well, I think the thing that finally happened with Margaret Walker, and I'm sure it probably happened also with you, Michael, with Sterling, is that at some point you were not the student, and she was not the teacher, but you were friends. What I wanted from Miss Margaret a great deal was to hear how she had made it through. I think it's so important for many women to understand how some women had to navigate 5 children, had to work, had to go back to school part-time, had to farm their children out to relatives, had to take care of a husband who had been injured in the war, had to live on $6,000 a year and do all of that and pay mortgage. I wanted to understand how she then could look up and in her midnight hours, in her midnight mornings, still write poetry and still be sane at the same time and still be not only an inspiration, but also give us the brilliant Jubilee, to give us the brilliant poetry that she did. And it was amazing that she wrote as much as she did, considering all of those, all of the things that she had to, you know, that she came up against.
Well, let's hear the poem that you've chosen. This is For My People. Margaret Walker recorded this in 1954.
For my people everywhere, singing their slave songs repeatedly, their dirges and their ditties, and their blues and jubilees, praying their prayers nightly to an unknown God, bending their knees humbly to an unseen power. For my people, lending their strength to the years, to the gone years and the now years and the maybe years. Washing, ironing, cooking, scrubbing, sewing, mending, hoeing, plowing, digging, planting, pruning, patching, dragging along, never gaining, never reaping, never knowing, and never understanding. For my playmates in the clay and dust and sand of Alabama backyards, playing baptizing and preaching and doctor and jail and soldier and school and mama and cooking and playhouse and concert and store and hair and Miss Chumbi and company. For the cramped, bewildered years we went to school to learn to know the reasons why and the answers to and the people who and the places where and the days when. In memory of the bitter hours when we discovered we were black and poor and small and different and nobody cared and nobody wondered and nobody understood. For the boys and girls who grew in spite of these things to be man and woman, to laugh and dance and sing and play and drink their wine and religion and success, to marry their playmates and bear children and then die of consumption and anemia and lynching. For my people thronging 47th Street in Chicago and Lenox Avenue in New York and Rampart Street in New Orleans, lost, disinherited, dispossessed, unhappy people, filling the cabarets and taverns and other people's pockets, needing bread and shoes and milk and land and money and something, something all our own. For my people walking blindly, spreading joy, losing time being lazy, sleeping when hungry, shouting when burdened, drinking when hopeless, tied and shackled and tangled among ourselves by the unseen creatures who tower over us omnisciently and laugh. For my people blundering and groping and floundering in the dark of churches and schools and clubs and societies, associations and councils and committees and conventions, distressed and disturbed and deceived and devoured by money-hungry, glory-craving leeches, preyed on by facile force of state and fad and novelty, by false prophet and holy believer. For my people standing staring, trying to fashion a better way from confusion, from hypocrisy and misunderstanding, trying to fashion a world that will hold all the people, all the faces, all the Adams and Eves, and their countless generations. Let a new earth rise. Let another world be born. Let a bloody peace be written in the sky. Let a second generation full of courage issue forth. Let a people loving freedom come to growth. Let a beauty full of healing and a strength a final clenching be the pulsing in our spirits and our blood. Let the martial songs be written. Let the dirges disappear. Let a race of men now rise and take control.
That was Margaret Walker reading her poem For My People, recorded in 1954, from the new CD anthology of African American poets called Our Souls Have Grown Deep Like the Rivers. My guests, poets Sonia Sanchez and Michael Harper, will be back after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guests are Sonia Sanchez and Michael Harper, two of the poets featured on the new CD, Our Souls Have Grown Deep Like the Rivers, Black Poets Read Their Work. You've both mentioned the importance of meeting Malcolm X. I'm wondering if his style of speaking affected you. I mean, because he was so powerful in the way he used words.
Oh, yes.
So did that have an impact on your writing or performing, do you think?
Oh, yeah.
Well,
go on.
You know, for me, Malcolm could bring you to tears because the first thing he did was shame you. And he shamed you because he was so straightforward, so honest. I remember, and you know, we had recordings of his speeches that we played to ourselves and to groups of people. And then later on, when I was teaching in the East Bay and a little bit north of Oakland, and we had people like Bobby Seale and various other people who were invited to the campus, you know, for outreach, for discussion and whatever. It was always Malcolm that was the focus of it all. And you know, you left your mind in Africa, he would say, or any one of a number of other slogans. And I know the impact was great on Sonia because at that time, of course, we were dispersed everywhere, but we were on the same page.
So, Sonia, what was the impact on your writing or performing style of meeting and speaking with Malcolm X?
Well, I think there was a dual thing. I think that one of the things that happened to any would-be writer at that time is that the moment you heard Malcolm speak, then your poems changed, the content changed, and also the way you delivered. We began to study Malcolm very carefully. We learned exactly how to read. I learned how to read a poem by listening to him. I learned, you know, because he was a master orator. He was a master person, you know, when it came to information. I began to infuse my poetry with African history because he would mention something in a speech someplace and you had no information on it. You run to the Schomburg. So you learn how to deliver your poetry by listening to him. So he was indeed a master teacher.
Now, I get the impression that music was also very influential on both of you.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Harper, do you feel that you have learned about language and its rhythms from reading with musicians, as you've occasionally done?
Absolutely. And the most important thing you learn from musicians is phrasing. And you learn it from the singers, you know, the Bessie Smiths, the Billie Holidays, the Mamie Smiths, the Aretha Franklins even. But you also learn more than anything else about the authenticity of phrasing because musicians take you to places that you might not necessarily want to go, and they go instantly to the transcendent. And, of course, the mastery of their playing is not technical mastery. It is spiritual mastery. It is to take you to a place that perhaps is not your mode. And when we are in performance with musicians, they take us to places sometimes we don't want to go. We're not prepared to go. They take us instantly there. And it seems to me that the pioneering efforts of great musicians, and Coltrane is just one of many, gives us a way, indicates the path. And of course, they're on the frontier, which is one of the reasons why we lose so many, because they're forced to live at the cutting edge of the society. And oftentimes, that's sacrifice to themselves. And I'm not only talking about drugs. I'm talking about the rigor with which they have to express themselves, bring themselves, and of course the pressure that black people in particular are under and always have been. The musicians they're the frontier. They're on the frontier, and you know, we have to learn how to follow.
Well, they were never protected, actually. You know, if you've ever been with musicians, I mean, really great ones, you're right. They do take you places you've never been before, and you go with them, and you realize that if they go here two and three sets at a time in one night, that is very dangerous. We do it maybe once with musicians, you see, but they do it two and three times a night. There was a time that these men and women played three sets a night in a smoke-filled club someplace. And you and I know that was not a healthy situation. So it's not just the obvious in terms of liquor, alcohol, and drugs, but it's also going each time to a place that is very hard to come down from. And an hour again, you're going up there again, too.
Sonia Sanchez, you teach at Temple University. Michael Harper, you teach at Brown University. You've both taught for a long time. I'm wondering if you feel most of your students are interested in poetry and where poetry seems to fit in culturally with the students that you teach now. Has rap had an impact for better or for worse on their interest in it? Does rap translate to an interest in printed poems? Sonia, your thoughts?
Well, I think that that rap has certainly influenced many of the students who come into my class. I've retired from Temple, so I'm not teaching anymore. And they come in quite often rhyming, writing raps. But they also, you teach them also Hayden and Walker and Brown and Brooks and Baraka and all the people who have written before, and they understand that. I think the joy of rap is that it has certainly brought them back to poetry, and now you can feed them all of the what I call the masters, the people who've gone before. They come with a rhythm. They come with an idea of rhyme, and you give them rhyme and dictionaries. You make them understand the need to go other places, the need, besides getting up on a stage and performing, also sitting down in a room someplace writing and learning and understanding what form is, and you teach form, and you make them deal with it in very real terms. And so therefore, you get some of the young rappers like Mos Def and Talib and Rakim and the people who are really writing some most fantastically beautiful things, which means that they are writing poetry, not just rap.
Michael Harper?
Well, the best of hip-hop and rap music, of course, has a certain resonance and a certain kind of sustained marvelous inventiveness that I think is in the best of all poetry. But I think that what young people have to realize is that they're not reinventing the wheel, that people have gone before. And what Sonia said briefly before was that she teaches literacy, and I think that's our responsibility, you know, for all young people. Young people are living in a contemporary time, and of course they think that the most important thing is the times that they're living in, but people have preceded them. That's why the tradition, that's why Sonia teaches the you know, a Margaret or a Hayden, that's why I teach a Sterling or Gwendolyn Brooks. I mean, who's written a better poem than We Real Cool by Gwendolyn Brooks? I mean, it's amazing. It's an amazing poem. That poem was written, I think, in 1959. And it might be a master poem for the 20th century, for all I know.
Michael Harper and Sonia Sanchez. They're two of the poets featured on the new double CD, Our Souls Have Grown Deep Like the Rivers, Black Poets Read Their Work. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Phyllis Myers, with Monique Nazareth, Anne Maria Baldonado, and Patty Leswing. I'm Terry Gross. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature an interview with director Brian De Palma. He directed the new film, Mission to Mars. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.